What this means in practical terms is that the fallen angels took the Creator's fabric of original creation and monkeyed with it so much that they created an entirely new reality, and one that just happens to be based upon a frequency of 435 MHz. This is a new timeline that is parallel to the Creator's but is only loosely related to His. The Christ consciousness is the interface from the created timeline to the original timeline. When Christ said you have to go through me to get to the Father, this is what he was talking about. If you have the original timeline of consciousness that was made by the superbeing, the distortions and perturbations are going to appear as waveforms around that original line. The whole operation can be diagnosed and evaluated on an electromagnetic basis, which is the means the space-time projects use to regulate consciousness. This is obviously a complex technical subject. It is thought that God is a super being and a millennia is just a blink of an eye to him and those on his timeline. We've gotten to the point where the blink of an eye has been manipulated and elongated into a drama of ridiculous proportions. What could be termed a simple thought of the Creator has become a pit of quicksand and manipulation within that thought. We have therefore dropped out of the Creator's thought. Original sin could be said to be disturbing the thought of the Creator to the point where we have an alternate creation of our own. It is this aspect which makes the Christ consciousness the sum total of our reality. This becomes quite clear when you realize that we can't access the Creator or even the realm where he exists. We are left to wonder, will he ever come back? The question of Christ or the Creator coming back to our reality can easily be put in perspective if you think about it being announced on the 6 o'clock news. This shows you how diametrically opposed the two concepts are. If Christ represents the original timeline and the 6 o'clock news represents our reality, the second coming or return of Christ can be better understood if we consider what I said earlier about the timeline of the Creator being parallel to the timeline of original sin. Eventually, if only with regard to sheer probability alone, these two lines are going to cross. It is from the geometric representation of this crossing that the Christian symbol of the cross is derived. Some people want to know if this crossing has already happened or if it will happen soon, and this can be a lively subject for debate. Obviously, a two-dimensional cross is a representation of one timeline being in touch with the other one. One could argue that the various saints had tapped into the original timeline when they worked their miracles. Christ on the cross represented the ultimate climax in terms of the two lines crossing. Of course, the two timelines very much went their separate ways after that incident. As it was related in the historical accounts of the Bible, not everyone was aware of the two timelines crossing. In fact, most of the recognition came after the fact and only after it was relayed through the media of that particular era. It is the same today. If we have a crossing, not everyone will necessarily be aware of it. For conventional science to recognize such an occurrence, it would have to come to terms with metaphysics, a very big and broad subject of which regular physics is just a small part. Metaphysics is a touchy subject for many scientists, and today some people who can no longer deny other dimensions like to use the word hyperdimensional physics. This is just a matter of semantics and should not be taken too seriously. These people are afraid they might be associated with carnival witches or astrologers if they embrace the word metaphysics. There is a genuine metaphysical knowledge base which can be fully tapped when the two timelines cross. You can already see elements of this beginning to happen in today's literature. It is like Columbus seeing twigs and birds before reaching land. The early religious database on this planet that was correct has been severely distorted by man, but there is still a basic underlying truth which can be understood as we continue to develop and evolve. Pursuing this angle, we can come to understand the true cosmic database and the original truth. One of the reasons why conventional science has a hard time embracing any of this is that they are in the hands of the manipulators. They are created to some degree and are certainly not acting with a creative consciousness. When someone has the good fortune to access the original timeline, they will find there is no room for manipulators or power mongers. It is a utopia without any need or motivation for war. A secret or formal government becomes utterly useless. The New Age or metaphysical movement is leading us towards a potential non-physical consciousness, and this is quite threatening to the established power base on planet Earth. If it succeeds, the control group will lose their significance. This is why they are spending huge sums on infiltrating the New Age movement and UFO circles. They are renowned for infiltrating a group and sending it in a direction that will suit the agenda of the secret government. The agendas chosen are almost always materialistic in nature. This is why you will sometimes see a popular psychic channel attacked in the media. Originally, they were communicating on a real spiritual level. Next, the true psychic source is attacked through some of the invasive techniques earlier described in this book. After that, the person doing the channeling is no longer accessing a pure source and becomes compromised. Big money is charged along with other practices that will offend middle-class America. The media then picks up the story and exposes another fraud. You get the idea. It is a pattern that has been repeating since we skewed off the original timeline. The Pleiadians have told me that if 10% of the beings in this galaxy can become conscious of the original timeline, then all beings will follow suit. They say that it is simply a matter of pure mathematics. If this is true, the only thing we have to do is spread the consciousness. I hope it is all that easy. May you have a pleasant journey on your way home. Part 2, by Peter Moon. Introduction to Part 2, by Peter Moon. After reading The Incredible Tales of Preston Nichols, it is sincerely hoped that you enjoyed yourself and, more importantly, learned something new about the universe around you. The purpose of the previous section was not only to inform but to put to rest once and for all some of the major doubt and nagging uncertainties that people have on the subject of UFOs and aliens. Any person with an open and logical mind should now have a heightened awareness and better grasp of these subjects. Those who still remain cynical at least have to admit that Preston has an orderly and exotic imagination that will not quit. Of course, Preston has not insisted that his adventures are definitive truth. He is open to the idea that some of his visitations or other paranormal experiences might be influenced by his subconscious or be the product of his inner imagination. Imagination is a very key word in this equation because it is synonymous to consciousness, and consciousness is the link to understanding all the mysteries of existence, whether they concern UFOs or the miracle of life. In the second section of this book, we are about to embark on an adventure in consciousness that will not only give further insights into the UFO phenomena but will tie the ancient myths of the Pleiades to Preston's theories concerning the original timeline. I will begin our adventure by laying a safety net in our approach to the more bizarre aspects of existence. From there, I will chronicle some of my own experiences with paranormal phenomena that led to my collaboration with Preston Nichols and the publication of his work. As we progress, a grander scheme of events will unfold, revealing the mystery of the Pleiades and the role they play in the consciousness of all. Chapter 24, The Psychology of UFOs. Modern psychology began with two major personalities, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. Freud was the father of psychoanalysis and found a sexual impulse behind every psychological dysfunction. He resoundingly rejected the paranormal and came into conflict with Jung, his former student and colleague. Jung extensively studied Oriental religions and the occult, incorporating what he learned from Freud with his own innovations. There was actually a third figure present at Freud's institute who, although more knowledgeable than both of these revered personalities, has yet to be heard of in most universities because his work has been suppressed. This figure was Wilhelm Reich, who absorbed the sexual teachings of Freud and the occult leanings of Jung and added it to his own research. Reich actually penetrated the human psyche as never before in terms of therapy. In his later years, he claimed to have built a ray gun that shot down UFOs. He was arrested on a trumped-up charge and placed in jail, where he died. His books were burned by government agents. Preston Nichols has discussed some of his work in the Montauk books. For purposes of this discussion, we are going to discuss the work of Carl Jung. His most brilliant act was to break down all of human psychology into archetypes. An archetype is defined as a prototype or model from which all other things are made. In human psychology, This means that our personalities can be broken down into basic stereotypical patterns that lurk beneath the surface of our social intercourse. These original prototypes existing within our psyche can be most easily viewed through mythological representations of the various gods. A quick study of the various pantheons will reveal heroes, thieves, betrayers, lovers, healers, poets, and just about any basic function of the human psyche. To a Jungian psychologist, the gods are merely the irreducible expression of how life functions. Our individual personalities are a combination of the various aspects. By sorting out the negative archetypes from the positive ones, we can get a better idea of who we are. By then tracing back the various behavior patterns as to why we assumed a negative archetype, we can clear ourselves of it and get along better in life. Jung studied this subject very deeply and wrote many books. He embraced tarot cards because they offer a strictly archetypal view of life. The tarot, in turn, is based upon the Holy Kabbalah, which is a philosophical system linking all faiths and mythologies in an effort to explain all human experience. In the last years of his life, Jung took notice of the UFO phenomena that had entered the culture in the 1950s. He not only saw flying saucers but even wrote a book about them. Despite his vast knowledge and a lifetime of study in the occult, he seems to have missed the boat entirely when it came to the study of UFOs. At least he acknowledged their presence. But nowhere did I ever read where he made a concerted effort to categorize the experiences associated with them into archetypal behavior patterns. Perhaps, this function was ahead of his time. Today, it is a much easier task with tales of Pleiadians, Orions and Sirians existing in our popular culture. The main point I am making with regard to UFOs is that they have to be accepted within the realm of human experience. Whether or not you have had an experience or believe in them is not the major criterion. The fact is that UFO phenomena have been reported upon in vast numbers during the last 50 years. The information can all be reduced to myths or tales that can be categorized with reference to traditional mythology, that is, psychological archetypes. This means that space people can exist within the context of any reference frame and be devils, angels, or something in between. This gives us not only psychological facts that we can grasp when we hear of different UFO experiences, but also allows us to study the subject in a sensible fashion without having encountered any hard evidence, which is another matter entirely. The psychological or archetypal reference point gives us a foundation from which we can begin to reduce the various lunacies that can easily creep into this subject. I am well aware that many of you in the reading audience have had experiences of abductions or UFO sightings. Some of you want validation that your experiences were heavenly, while others are trying to unwrap themselves from a tangle of trauma. There are also many who, misguided or not, are seeking such contact or are curious about it. Studying the subject of UFOs, etc. from the above reference point and finding out where your experiences fit in will provoke your intellect to interface with phenomena that might otherwise appear to be unexplainable. Where you fall short in your understanding, you can always refer to mythology for some sort of answer. Mythology not only offers a safety net for our study, it is the backbone upon which all civilizations are based. This is the background from which I tell my personal story. And it doesn't really matter whether what I say happened actually did happen. Of course, I would tell you that it did because I believe it to be so. The important point is that I experienced these events and that they tie into a stream of consciousness, which includes yourself. If not, you wouldn't be reading this book. My purpose here is to ignite your own quantum dynamic function in order that you can better recognize your own native consciousness and reach out towards your own unlimited potential. Chapter 25, Angelic Influence. Probably the most unique aspect of my childhood is that I was the only kid on my block who was not baptized into the Christian faith. This distinction might have held up for several miles, except it stands to reason that there were probably a few others who escaped this time-honored ritual. My parents both grew up Catholic. Although my mother went to Catholic school and my father had served as an altar boy, that was the end of it. They were married by a judge and stayed away from the church. Only later in my life would I begin to get an idea of why. One morning I was having breakfast with a psychic friend of mine and I wondered casually if my father could have been related to Nikola Tesla. She looked intensely at me and interrupted my conversation. "Your father detested organized religion, didn't he?" "Yes, as a matter of fact," I answered. "This psychic told me quite positively that a priest had tried to molest my father. She said my father had trusted the cloth, clergy, and it had betrayed him. I don't know if this is true, but it explained a pattern in my father's behavior. He ranted and raved against the Catholic Church whenever given an opportunity. He also described the priests as drunkards, saying they would sit around and ask him for more wine after the sacraments. Consequently, I was protected from the church, although I was never forbidden to attend. Despite all this, the divine did find its way into my life at an early age. One day the kids in my neighborhood were talking about guardian angels. Most of these children were Catholic and often told me what they learned in their catechism classes. On this particular day, the subject was guardian angels and I was introduced to an entirely new concept. After listening to my friends and returning home, I asked my mother if she believed in guardian angels. Somewhat to my surprise, she gave me an affirmative, yes. Upon asking her why, she told me that I had been saved by a guardian angel when I was a small baby. It occurred on a hot day in Newell, California when she had put me in a stroller and let it rest under the shade of a large tree. She sat on the porch not too far away. According to her story, a large branch of the tree began to give way. It was not a gradual break and was obviously going to crush me in just a matter of seconds. My mother was too far away to reach me in time and for a split second felt the horror of possibly losing her baby. There was no way I could survive the fall of that branch. As the branch began to fall, a very strong gust of wind appeared and blew my stroller out of harm's way. The day had been very hot with no sign of wind before or after that occurrence. That it was strong enough to push the stroller was most remarkable to her. Despite growing up Catholic, she had abandoned her faith and was not really a religious woman at all, but this experience led her to believe in guardian angels. I would later learn that a Greek goddess named Alcyone was one of the seven Pleiades and that she controlled the fate of storms and winds. As I have no personal recollection of the incident in the stroller, I cannot say if the above occurrence was celestial intervention by a higher power or just dumb luck. It would seem that some force in the universe wanted me to stay around for a while. Chapter 26, Take Me Out of the Ball Game. My next paranormal experience was in puberty. I was 12 years old and the maturation process was just about to take a big step. I remember playing little league baseball and having a tremendous headache. Every time I would throw a ball or swing a bat, shockwaves would go through my system. The normal thing to do would have been to tell the coach to take me out of the game, but I wouldn't do that. In fact, he said that he wanted me in the game and was looking forward to me helping the team. We were mostly a losing team. But that night we were playing the best team in the league and he wanted to win. I was in some other zone of consciousness and figured I would just go through the motions and eventually go home. It hurt so much to swing a bat that I decided I would let every pitch go by. This decision proved to be more painful because the pitcher didn't throw any balls over the plate and I walked to first base. I discovered it hurt even more to walk than it did to swing a bat. Much to my own surprise, I was batted around the bases and scored a run. The pain was intense. Our team was doing well. But I wanted us to lose so that I could go home. As painful as it was to swing a bat, I realized that it was less painful than running around the bases. I resolved to swing at every pitch and strike out. This sort of attitude on my behalf was strange because up to that time sports were my only interest in life. There was nothing else and for me to adopt such a mentality was not in keeping with my usual self. Despite the pain, I swung at the ball and made purposeful outs the next two times up. Much to everyone's surprise, our team stayed in the game and kept it close. By this time, most of the team knew I was acting funny. I was hoping the coach would take me out, but he let me bat with runners on base. I went up to the plate with the express purpose of striking out. On the third strike, I accidentally hit the ball for a game-winning hit. It felt absolutely horrible. As my team began to celebrate, I hoped the end of the game would bring me some sort of relief. Instead, my stomach began to feel unsettled. It was my father's turn to buy the Cokes after the game, and I asked him to buy me too. Hopefully, the carbonation would ease my discomfort. This trick worked just long enough to get me home. Upon entering my bedroom, I heaved up the spaghetti dinner I had eaten before the game. I completely lost any normal functionality. My mother cleaned up the rather extensive mess and helped me get to bed. That night was one of the most horrible experiences of my life. I don't know if it was simply a nightmare or an abduction of some sort, but I felt that my mind was being ransacked by a very large and powerful computer. I remember seeing reel-to-reel tapes like the old computers of the 1960s. It seemed to be probing every possible memory fiber that could exist within my mind, and the operation was accompanied by extreme pain and forcefulness. The process was continued repeatedly, and I began to scream louder and louder. Perhaps they were checking out my pain threshold. I have screamed in dreams before where the sound never translated to the physical plane. In other words, people sleeping in the next room didn't hear anything. In this case, my father heard me from down the hall and came in to see what all the fuss was about. He never showed much interest in anything metaphysical or paranormal, but he was fascinated by what I told him and wanted to hear as much information as I could tell him. It was all rather odd. The intense form of mental intrusion that I experienced lasted only one night, but I found that I could not keep any food down afterwards. After a few days, I began to throw up stomach acid and my mother became very concerned. A week later, she took me to the doctor. He was pretty grim and indicated I could die if I was unable to eat for much longer. The doctor had no idea what was wrong with me. He may have given me a shot of penicillin, but I don't remember. There was no reassurance of any kind nor any suggestion that I could be put on intravascular support. If I couldn't eat after 10 days, we were to call him again and expect the worst. By the 10th day, I could no longer walk out of sheer weakness. My parents and I were waiting on pins and needles. My spirits were considerably raised by the fact my best friend's father, a former neighbor, was coming to visit. I was reduced practically to skin and bones, and I don't know if this friend's presence did the trick, but I was able to retain my food for the first time in 10 days. When he suggested I return with him and spend the next week in my old neighborhood, my spirits soared. I was able to eat some more and began to regain a little strength. I soon began to walk a bit. My father was concerned about my going away in such a weak condition, but he was persuaded by my enthusiasm and by his friend. I took the trip and experienced a complete resurgence of my emotions, inspired in no small part by visiting my old neighborhood haunts. My physical health returned quickly. Even though I fully recovered, I occasionally wondered if someone was spying on me and could watch my every move. I never linked it to the previously mentioned experience, but simply thought it was something everyone must think about from time to time. The thought of someone spying on me didn't really disturb me too much because I considered the possibility to be very remote. All in all, this experience at the onset of puberty had changed me. It was very unlike me to abandon my little league team and my first love, which had been sports. Of course, it is not so unusual for interests to change during adolescence, but my shift in behavior and interests was accompanied by a rather forceful intrusion upon my consciousness. Chapter 27, Missing Time. 3 years after the abduction incident, I moved to another town and was socially displaced. Having no friends for about a year, I discovered science fiction and other literature which is designed to open up the higher aspects of the mind. The most influential works I studied during this time period were the novels of Hermann Hesse, a German mystery school initiate. This path climaxed when I read a book entitled The Master Game by Dr. Robert S. Darop, a biochemist who was also an occultist. This book described the fact that there were different games in life. I don't remember exactly how he categorized them, but they were rather funny. There was the hog and trough game for people who were only concerned with their immediate subsistence and had no time or consciousness for anything else. Just above this was cock on dunghill, which referred to ego-driven individuals who like to gloat in the glory of their own fame. This game could apply to gurus who lead people about, or even a boss of a small office who gets off on his own power and the admiration he needs from others. There were other categories I do not recall, but at the top of the list was what he called the master game. This was a game of all games and included the objective of reaching your total potential. Several initiations began at this point, which were of a deeply personal nature and culminated in me making a total commitment to increasing my awareness to its full potential. At this point, I quickly discovered there were two major taboos in society. One was obviously sex, as the sexual revolution was getting a lot of media play in those days. That didn't require any great powers of observation. The second taboo, considerably more important, was the taboo on becoming more aware. I found that people could not even discuss the subject with any degree of objectivity. Programmed thought abounded in the society, and still does, and it wasn't very encouraging. Two important truths I learned during this time period have served me incredibly well. First, all proper path work or initiation work begins from the heart. In other words, you should not engage in any activities that you don't really believe in. For me, this eliminated just about any possible career. The second truth was that your only true teacher is yourself. Alan Watts, in a book titled Psychotherapy East and West, explained that gurus and Zen masters had been a noble tradition in the Orient as far back as anyone could remember. He also said that the culture expectation for these masters was that they were all fakes. Part of this expectation also included the fact that most people would seek them out in spite of their potential for fakery. Ultimately, they would discover the charade. This observation was further modified by the character of the different masters. Some were at least more ethical than others, or were more compatible with particular pupils. One could learn something from a teacher, but the lessons could not be properly learned unless you experienced them yourself. This was a wonderful warning then and still applies today. Gurus are a load of crap. Once you know the ground rules, you can interface with them and possibly learn something. If you know this, at least you can't complain later that you were fooled. You alone are the master of your own fate. Another point taught by Darop is that each one needs to generate his own magnetic center in order to find like minds and compatible groups through which one can learn. Although I lived in a hippie-laden community at this point, most of these people were too drug-oriented to seriously consider real consciousness exploration. I wrote to Darop in hopes of finding some method of accelerating my learning and evolutionary process. He didn't live too far away. His reply was most interesting. He told me to finish school, decide on a career and apply for admission to the League. This was a reference to Hermann Hesse's mystical group mentioned in Journey to the East. This appeared to be great gamesmanship on his part, but it was also practical advice and sincerely offered. I asked him further questions and he referred me to a man in San Francisco whose family supposedly had a long tradition of serving the League. I was interested in pursuing all this from a strictly esoteric angle. Little did I know that this man's family was tied to the UFO field. But I did not find this out until many years later. This particular family also carries a lineage that is tied to the Montauk Indians. I am not at liberty right now to reveal the family's name, as it could possibly hamper some of their unfinished business. All of this was a rather interesting line of endeavor to pursue, but it would be interrupted by a new adventure for me. That was Scientology, a word that evokes a definite emotional response to all who have heard something about it. Before I say anything further about that subject, it should be understood that I have not been actively involved with Scientology organizations for over 12 years. I do not rant and rave against them, nor do I rah-rah their PR lines. I can maintain objectivity on this subject, which in my experience is practically an unheard-of capability. It would require an entire book to properly represent all my experiences in the proper context, and that would be very difficult indeed. Scientology is basically simple, but it requires indoctrination and an understanding of its own languages to be properly understood. for an outsider to properly understand it. He or she has to become an insider. I will therefore cut things to extreme simplicity and tell you only a few salient points. Scientology means to know in the deepest sense of the word. It comes from the root seo, which means to know or to cleave. Cleave means to cut, but it also means to differentiate. The basic definition of the word and ultimate goal is the same as the Gnostics, deriving from gnosis, which likewise means to know in the fullest sense of the word, but they go about it in a totally different manner.